My name's Henry Widdis. I live in Lancashire in the United Kingdom. I've been a mainstream journalist for about 20, well, since 20, the year 2000. That's when I qualified with my NCTJ. And I've just worked in local papers across all the major newspaper groups in that time. Past sort of 10, 15 years, I've been involved with the National Union of Journalists. And it's with that hat I'm speaking to you today. With that, wearing that, and also, the opinions I'll be offering are my own, but I am keen to get the National Union of Journalists involved with improving trust in the mainstream media.
Well, that
But
would be nice, wouldn't it?
yes.
But because I think that we are in Britain are actually one of the worst countries for people trusting what they see on the news, despite what you might think from their own propaganda. But can you start by saying something what you think, what you make of the choice of journalism as a career and as a profession? Because it is an interesting job. I mean, for me, I chose the job because I wanted to have a new challenge every day. I didn't want to be doing a sort of 9 to 5 job, which was not going to be constantly sort of challenging my intellect, you know. So what do you make of the profession as a whole and its place amongst all the other professions that we could, you know, people could go into?
Well, yeah, I see it as the fourth estate. It's like, it's a very important industry. It's something I've really enjoyed working in. There's been like ups and downs, highs and lows, but the reward you get from it is fantastic. You're helping people in the community, digging down into stories, investigations. And now I'm sort of in a sort of sub-editor role, but helping the new recruits, the new reporters, and seeing them flourish. And they're dealing in a situation where that there are chronic staffing issues, so it is difficult for them. And there's like increasing levels of bureaucracy and public relations officers who are quite aggressive in terms of not wanting anything critical said about their organizations, like the police, the health service, councils. So they have got a difficult job, but it's there's a camaraderie and a feeling of being part of a team that's always been there in my career, and it's they're a really nice bunch of people, newspaper journalists. I have worked in broadcast media a bit as well, just on a sort of work experience level. I found there to be more egos at that level than at newspaper level. And
Yeah,
I
I
know
think I
you're in
agree.
broadcast, so that you're a fine
Yeah,
example
well,
of.
I mean, one of the things that I've got to ask you about, Henry, is this whole difference between public relations and journalism. Because quite a lot of people who've trained as journalists find they can actually have an easier career and make a lot more money doing public relations. So, what's the difference?
There has been a gravitation over the decades of reporters moving towards public relations. Sometimes there's better pay on offer. It's a more regular 9 to 5 type job. For reporters, you quite often have to do weekend shifts, and if you're the crime reporter and a murder happens, you might get sent out of hours to cover it. And that's happened to me in the past when I was a crime reporter for about 4 or 5 years. But there have been reporters who've gone into public relations, found it incredibly tiresome with the levels of checking to get a press release out, whereas they could churn out a news story in like half a day, even like a big feature. Whereas if you want to do something like that in public relations, you'd be looking at a couple of weeks. So people do gravitate back as well to newspapers from public relations. But yeah, there does tend to be a shift of those who maybe they want to settle down with a family. They do want the more regular hours, maybe a bit more income. So yeah, there is a bit of a pull there towards
Yeah,
public
but
relations.
isn't it, don't you think, see,
Can I
there's a
just,
bit of
before
a,
you
is
finish
it,
it, there's a
yeah.
joke that we use for those who do go into public relations. It's joining the dark side. And I think I still that has an element of truth to it, because as much as some people are disappointed with the way the mainstream news is sometimes, they're still a valuable asset to have, and they do question authority. Whereas public relations is the direct opposite of that. They don't want that authority questioned. So it's just like
Yeah, I
there is
was
a bit
going
of
to
a
say
battle.
it's a bit like poacher turned gamekeeper from one going from one to the other, but because there is a, you know, a qualitative difference, a PR person is trying to push a positive image for a company, and some of those companies can be the biggest possible transnationals who are committing the most horrific atrocities, crimes even, and yet they're trying to push that line. And it does strike me that, you know, during the 30 years or so I've been in journalism, what is it roughly now, that the PR people seem to be doing quite well in getting their stories stronger and stronger in the national press, and that there are less and less questions being asked by particularly the London media. And Britain is a peculiar country amongst a lot of others in that almost all the national and international journalists are based in London, where we used to have the Manchester Guardian years ago. Even that got sucked down to London. So there's very little national or international news coverage from the regions here. But look, let's just get into this whole business of unions. We're chatting during the RMT strike, or it was just the first three strikes last week. The trade union movement saying, well, basically, we're not prepared to put up with pay cuts, with massive redundancies. And the trade unions were thought by many to be sort of rather weak in the present time. But the train drivers of the RMT union seem to have proved that wrong. What do you make of the journalists union? Because we don't hear too much about that in the national press, do we?
No, I mean, I don't think we're quite as strong as maybe like, you know, the rail workers unions, which historically have been very strong. But the National Union of Journalists is like, it is accredited journalism. You know, I've worked at newspaper groups that haven't, or newspaper titles rather, that haven't had union recognition. And it's like chalk and cheese when you move to a newspaper that has got the union recognition, you get better terms and conditions, better pay. So yeah, they are 100% worthwhile. They're really good in terms of sort of tackling issues like bullying as well. And as a union rep, I've just been able to liaise with editors and things like that in terms of ensuring that workflows are as good as they can be and ensuring staff aren't working past their hours. So yeah, on that level, it's been good. Sometimes it's quite difficult to get a decent pay rise because we are in an industry that's battling with increasing printing costs. I mean, they're sort of doubled over the past couple of years or something. And there's also the drop in advertising, especially during the COVID era. So yeah, it has been difficult, but we have managed to get sort of decent pay rises over the years at different newspaper groups. And I do get the feeling that without the union, it will be much worse. But one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you in this interview is about the work that I've carried out to get the union to try and make sure that they can keep mainstream news having those trust levels that are dropping. I mean, they're dropping around the world, not just this country. And one way to do that is just ensure that, especially on the broadcast news, that they're holding authority to account properly, and that the PR companies aren't winning, as they were sort of saying. Maybe in some cases they do seem to have the upper hand.
Yeah, but what you've just said is slightly different to the pay and conditions side of it, isn't it? This is also, what you're suggesting here is that the union is having some sort of an input into the what people see and read and hear as well, because my experience is, and I know for outsiders they won't necessarily know, that within the workplace the NUJ organizes in these groups called chapels, and we have Mothers of Chapel and Fathers of Chapel, which is a throwback to the old sort of non-conformists, the old Methodists and people like that from the old days. I suppose when the unions were very young, these nonconformist churches were quite strong, but my experience is in editorial too, particularly in the BBC, that the push against the sort of government pressure that there's been within the BBC to push the government line, a lot of the pushback, the professional pushback for the benefit of the listeners and the viewers, has come from within the union, from within these chapels.
Yeah, I mean, and in our case, one of the chapels that I represented, going back to 2020, we wrote a letter to the head of the union, and in sort of May 2020, we wrote quite a strong letter, because at the time we were worried about the guidelines from the government were going to cause some financial problems for newspaper groups around the country, which could in turn results in job losses, which is something union reps want to avoid at all costs. So yeah, we wrote to the union, and there's four key points that we wanted them to raise, which was number one was to push the government to consider all the scientific data and opinion, including that around the accuracy of COVID-19 testing and recordings of death and the effectiveness of the lockdowns and the social distancing. And then two, to question the government on the SAGE guidance. And for those who don't know, that SAGE is the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies that sort of helps the Cabinet Office in terms of how to approach the pandemic. And interestingly, they're filled with a lot of psychologists, which is quite a worry, something that we
And also, I mean, very importantly, SAGE were chaired by Sir Jeremy Farrar, who was one of the top people, if not the director, I'm not quite sure of his role, at the Wellcome Trust, which is really the British origin of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So this was something that was going on in Britain for many, many years before the Gates Foundation was ever even thought of. And he is the guy basically looking after these private so-called charitable interests of the Wellcome Trust. He's in charge of SAGE. Actually, he resigned towards the end of it, I believe. I mean, probably I think it was late 2021 he resigned, but without any proper explanation, really. But these are the people who have a massive vested interest in pushing vaccines and vaccination in general that have it seems, running the policy on behalf of the government.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an interesting point there, because that was the third point that we were raising with in this letter to the head of the union, was, you know, to demand why the government was explaining the reasons for lockdown and social distancing at the start to flatten the curve. And then the health secretary at the time, Matt Hancock, he was saying that now, okay, we flattened the curve, but we're going to continue locking down until everyone's been vaccinated. And then I thought, wow, that's quite a shift of goalposts there. And then we also wanted a very important point. We wanted the NUJ to challenge global media platforms on the censorship of, like, medical experts and scientific experts who, you know, gave opinions that conflicted with the World Health Organization guidelines. So there was a lot of censorship going on in the early days of the alleged pandemic, and that was, you know, shaping public opinion. So, yeah, well, unfortunately, that letter...
Well, hang on, Henry, because you just used the expression alleged pandemic. What you're suggesting there is that maybe there was no pandemic at all. And I think, you know, quite a few viewers will find that a bit shocking thing to say.
Well, the way to explain that is that the definition of pandemic was changed, where I think pandemic previously was defined by how many people died, you know, X amount died per million. And then it was changed to the number of cases per million. So deaths was suddenly removed from the definition of pandemic. So that's why, you know, some people, you know, it's quite a commonly held belief that some people don't think there has been a pandemic in the true sense of the word, where there's been a huge spike in deaths. And you can go to Office of National Statistics to show that, where the number of deaths per million, I think somewhere in the past 20 years, 2020 was like only about the 12th worst out of, you know, so there was 8 or 9 years worse in terms of death per million in earlier years, going back to...
Okay, so I suppose what you're saying really is, I don't want to put words into your mouth, that would be terribly unprofessional, Henry, but is that under the old definition, it actually didn't fulfil the quite criteria for a pandemic.
Yes, and then some people argue that by changing the definition of pandemic to not include deaths, it became easier to have these draconian rollouts, which... you know, some people think it's about control. I, you know, again, I did say at the start of offering my own personal opinions here, not that of the National Union of Journalists. But, you know, I do believe that we're on a slippery slope to losing our freedoms. And, you know, that slope has been increasing in its steepness. And, you know, that's why we need a robust mainstream media that's holding authority to account, you know, not just at local level, not just at national level, but at geopolitical level. And so, you know, like you were gave an example of conflicts of interest there at SAGE, those things need to be looked at in depth with a sustained level of coverage to make sure the public are aware that there are, you know, movers and shakers at global level who have an interest in making the world seem like there is a pandemic, when in fact the levels of death are no worse than any other year on average, if you look past the past 20 years.
Well, yeah, I think what we've seen is we've seen quite a lot of figures put forward who their actual interest in one outcome or another when it comes to mass vaccination hasn't really been talked about by the journalists who are interviewing them, and they're not really cross-examining them. I think there was, when you're talking about the SAGE guidance to the media there was a sort of state of fear amongst journalists that they should just simply accept what they're being told. But the thing is, you can maybe accept that from a government official, but a journalist's job is to point out when people have vested interests, and that very, very little of that was done. Or, you know, and it was a bit like we were getting chalk and cheese. So some people, talking heads on the TV, have got a vested interest, but they're not being told about it. And others, for example, like Alison Pollock from, I think, is it Newcastle University, who was calling the treatment of people not being able to see their loved ones in care homes, not being able to go to hospital, as barbaric, for example, got very little coverage. And the separation between people who were independent experts and those that had a vested interest of some sort wasn't really made by journalists. And I think that was, you know, if you put my two hypotheses in, that was one of the major failings that we've seen structurally in the way the whole thing was covered. But anyway, just go on to, back to the NUJ. You approached the General Secretary, Michelle Stanistreet. What did you get a reply? Was it a quick reply? What sort of reply did you get?
Yeah, it was basically, so yeah, she's been great responding to us, you know, to the concerns of the chapel, because obviously, you know, the chapel members are the union. She's just there as a conduit to listen to what the union members want. So she really appreciated the letter. And she was a bit confused, though. I think at the time, because it was like May 2020, she thought that, you know, things were over and we're going to settle down. But, you know, because I sort of looked into independent media reports of, you know, how the sort of the shakeup of things during the COVID era, it was actually almost, there's documents showing it was planned, you know, earlier than that. So I got the feeling back then that this wasn't going to be over anytime soon. But then, unfortunately, she went on Radio 5 Live a week or two afterwards to express her opinions about the NUJ's role and, you know, the mainstream media's role. And she thought that at that time, because, you know, there had been a big spike in deaths in, you know, was it March, April time, that the newspapers and the national media were acting in a life-saving role by you know, promoting the government message. And I didn't see that. I saw that as a conflict with the letter that we'd sent to the NUJ to actually challenge the government rather than be just repeating what they're saying.
Well, no, and I think, to be fair, you know, there will be differing views. And of course, the London media, Henry, you know, is not necessarily thinking what the Northwest Manchester media, etc., are thinking. They're thinking different things. You know, they're not all in lockstep, thank God. So she would probably be being pulled in different directions, particularly from her friends closer to her physically in London.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I appreciate, she's got an incredibly difficult job. She was having to liaise with, you know, cabinet ministers. And during that time, she managed to win the right for journalists to be counted as, you know, the key workers. But in my mind, I actually disagree with that move. I mean, to me, a journalist is a member of the public. We're all just members of the public. You know, we are trained in ethics and, you know, how to report and make sure, you know, we're getting both sides of the stories and, you know, can do our shorthand and stuff. But at the end of the day, a journalist is just a member of the public. We've got the same, you know, fears and opinions as everyone else. But, you know, we're trained to not put those opinions forward. So, yeah, she was in a difficult position where she was, you know, no one was sure what was going to be happening back then. But anyway, this is a continuing dialogue that we've
Yeah,
got.
I think, can I just, sorry, just to interrupt briefly, because I think the reason that the union said that was because the restrictions being brought in the spring of 2020 were so draconian that, that it was understood that there had to be some kind of, when I say draconian, I mean, you know, the actual suspension of basic human rights, like the freedom to travel, the right to speak to somebody, you know, these kinds of things were all being restricted. And so I think quite rightly there was pushback from some professions, particularly, I mean, journalism. You would think, you know, this is something which we need to be able to proceed and go ahead and not to be told you can't do your job, you've got to stay at home, you've got to try and raise people on the phone, all that sort of thing. You know, it put enormous restrictions on journalists. So personally, I'm quite glad to see that the that there were, at the very least, some sort of pushback against these restrictions on human rights.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's a good point, because we have photographers going out and about, and of course, if they weren't key workers, they could have been like arrested by the police for you going, you know, with it outside of boundaries of, you know, their office or home address. So it was good on that level. But yeah, I just don't see journalists as being key workers myself, but that's just a personal view. But yeah, just to carry on with the union, we're still in dialogue with them. And there's another group that I've set up, you know, to encourage best practice in the mainstream news called Holding Authorities to Account. So the full name's Journalists Against COVID Censorship, Holding, sorry, I'm getting it wrong here, Holding the Line. So I'll just repeat that. It's Journalists Against COVID Censorship, Holding the Line.
So yes, so the website for that,
for short.
And the website for that is www.holding-the-line.com, is it?
Or
is
it? No, it is dot com, actually. Yeah, so holding-the-line.com. Yeah,
okay.
And you've got lots of journalists writing great stories there from as far as New Zealand, from France. You know, we've got members from Texas, Canada, Italy. So yeah, it's quite a bit of a global organization.
Yeah, it's drawn in quite a lot of journalists that also feel similarly that that the profession has really suffered during the pandemic, and that that actually quite a lot of the high standards that we try and hold our profession to have been really smashed. I mean, particularly through in the UK here, we've seen, as you mentioned, through Sage advising the media that they should just toe the government line. Well, this is anathema to many journalists. This is our job, is to hold the government to account. Anyway, carry on, Henry. Sorry, you know,
I think that
whole idea of holding the line is quite important, and it's brought quite a few journalists in, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Yeah, I mean, from the mainstream, independent journalists, retired journalists, yeah, you name it. People from like public relations have helping us out as well. We've got graphic designers, video editors helping us for producing content.
But it's worth saying as well that there have been some members who, because of their jobs as staff journalists, have found it less easy to speak out, whereas people, freelancers like myself, you know, it's normal for me. But for some staff journalists, they've had to kind of keep their head down a bit.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, an environment where you don't want to be, you know, there's always glass ceilings, editorial glass ceilings within the industry. Then you know, go back decades, you know, it's what one of those things where, you know, you just have to deal with it and you were to respect it to a certain extent, but you try and push back where you can. And, you know, there's always healthy, robust editorial debates going on in the newsroom. You know, I've experienced a few and, you know, there's never been any malice or anything there. It's, you know, sometimes there are differences of opinion. But, you know, a very good point you made about Sage, and something that we have raised with the union is, there's a group called the, I think SPIB is the acronym, and it's the Scientific Pandemic Insight Group. And they offer allegedly independent advice to Sage. And they were actually in the minutes of their meeting were suggesting that the mainstream news should be used as a tool to encourage social disapproval of those who don't want to go along with the COVID guidelines. And that has caused such a monumental amount of damage across families. You know, I know, especially in Europe, where like fathers and sons of parents have disowned their sons for not being injected. And Yeah, it is quite sad when you hear about these stories. And I mean, I've had some personal relationship difficulties as well by, questioning the narrative because some people are, so, they've bought the mainstream narrative to such an extent that they still think they're in extreme danger. And, there are elderly people out there still too scared to go
Well,
outside, and
look,
their
okay, look,
quality of
this is
life
the
has been
kind of
destroyed.
$64,000 question in a way, Henry. How do you get across, to individuals to help them to make the right decision when it comes to getting vaccinated or not?
Well, I think you just have to, like, I mean, the part of this holding the line group is that we're just looking to encourage best practice in the mainstream media. And one of that is to make sure journalists are clued up on things like the yellow card scheme, the government yellow card scheme, which sort of records the number of deaths and injuries from the injections. So, yeah, if that can be reported in context with stories and, like, maybe we get like a press release encouraging members of the public to be injected, there should be reporting on the injection harm that's taken place as well to give both sides of the story. But yeah, it's not always easy to be doing that. And there has been a bit of a divide between the independent media and the mainstream. So yeah, I think at Holding the Line, we're looking to bridge that gap to make sure that both sectors of news can learn from each other. Perhaps that the independent news can learn about sort of our ethical and professional practices, and maybe we can learn more in terms of holding authorities to account. But it is so difficult out there because we're especially when you're a journalist and you've got to build contacts and stuff, you can't go around asking questions that are going to be ripping the foundations of a narrative out the window. So yeah, I think just little soft steps in the right direction can make a difference. Yeah, so I think, yeah, overall, I think we are making progress in that Holding Line. We've also carried on our dialogue with the union, where we were concerned before Christmas last year. There was a few articles in national newspapers, and I think also some talk on some phone-ins and things like that on national TV about concerns about those who chose not to be vaccinated in terms of them being social pariahs or a real danger to society, where to one extent I think there was a report suggesting that those who don't want to get COVID injected are terrorists in some ways. And to me it went too far. It went into what was approaching, or we might say flirting, with hate speech. So we passed our concerns to the ethics committee of the NUJ, and we gave examples about six or seven stories. And yeah, they actually talked about our concerns at their ethics committee, I think back in April of this year, and yeah, or possibly March. And they came
So
back.
that's 2022, just to be
Yes,
clear,
that's
yeah.
this year. Yeah, and yeah, spring this year, and they came back with a resolution that they didn't think those articles crossed the border into hate speech because it was a very diverse subject, a bit like Brexit, so people are going to have very, very strong views about it. And they thought it was important that those journalists had their freedom of speech protected, even if they are saying that those who choose not to be vaccinated are equivalent to terrorists. So I disagree with that, but that was their finding. There's a committee on there, so yeah, you just have to raise awareness about these issues. And of course, if things get worse, we can go back to them and say, look, there's an increased level of hatred against those choosing not to be vaccinated appearing again. But I think, touch wood, that hasn't happened again. But we'll see what happens again this winter.
Okay, so what would you say is the achievements of holding the line?
Yeah, I think just raising awareness about good practice in journalism. And we did an absolutely fantastic story. I'm going to name check Roger Guttridge here, who's a retired journalist for like 50 years. And he got hold of an email from a health group who were looking to advertise in the New York Times and the Washington Post about just using various vitamins and supplements to help protect you against COVID-19. And they were willing to pay like tens of thousands of dollars to both those titles to run this advertisement, you know, not offering any new product, just saying that, you know, if you want to protect yourself against this disease, try boosting your vitamin C levels, your vitamin D, et cetera, and zinc and iron. And yet the advertising departments took the money, and then both those titles very shortly after came back with guidance from their legal department saying that they couldn't run those adverts because it went against the FDA guidance on there being no cure for COVID-19 or no way to reduce its symptoms. And this was before the COVID injections were released. So that to me is quite a significant story where two international newspapers were not willing to give advertising to supplements that are already on the market known to benefit health. And of course, you know, you've yourself have done a lot of work on ivermectin, and you know that again was another drug that was blocked. And yeah, it's just unfortunate. You do have to think that possibly the levels of death were inadvertently increased by not having the dialogue in terms of alternative treatments that weren't injection based.
Well, I mean, Tess Laurie, who's championed this in here in Bath, Dr. Tess Laurie, she estimated that something like 60,000 people in Britain could have died because they hadn't been offered one of these antiviral, very cheap, out-of-patent drugs such as chloroquine or ivermectin. Now, they're not designed as antivirals, but they have this as a serendipitous side effect of what they do. And, you know, anecdotally, a friend of mine, he just popped a chloroquine pill the day he started feeling these COVID-like symptoms, and he said within half an hour the symptoms were gone. So I think the key thing is that these things are quite useful. In some countries, such as Peru, they had vehicles full, well, not full, but with plenty of these pills in, and anyone who started to feel the symptoms could call a health service number, and the vehicle would come straight round to their house in one of the major cities and deliver them with one of these antiviral pills. And this was certainly a treatment. And it's bizarre that we were told there was no treatment. The only thing, the only kind of knight in shining armor was going to be this vaccine, which actually hadn't been tested on things like pregnant women, the very elderly vulnerable, the young, for example, but then was approved for the, you know, to be used with everybody, completely sidestepping all of the normal safety procedures. Anyway, the other thing I think important to say at this stage, Henry, is that for us as journalists, we can see how all those various stories are sort of lobbying and sides of the story are lobbying away within the newsroom, with journalists sometimes or editors pushing a particular line in order to, you know, start the ball rolling on a story. And we had a very, very strong, I think, imbalance between the basically the pro-vaccine side and the anti-vaccine side. So the people who are being more sceptical. So, for example, something called the Science Media Centre, which is funded by many university departments, which are in themselves, if you look into it, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And they have a tremendous amount of funding at the Science Media Centre, and pitted against them are organisations with basically no funding, such as Doctors for COVID Ethics, or very little funding. PANDA, the Pandemic Data and Analysis Group in South Africa, the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development Group, BIRD, the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine. So it was a quite a not a level playing field, where some very well-funded lobby groups were able to pay to get their view across. And then in the background to all of that, we've got the Sage Guidance, which is twisting the arm of the editors behind their back to say what the government tells you to say, and say what the World Health Organization tells you to say.
Well, I'm certainly not aware of that editorial pressure on anywhere I work, but I have heard from Mark, I should remember his name now. He's helped set up a group called News Uncut, Mark Sharman. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's a retired journalist, and he's sort of was very high up in Sky News, and he did a fantastic interview with Anna Breeze, talking about the pressures at Sky News not to report on COVID injection injuries. And I thought that was quite shocking to hear that, you know, a sort of a respected news outlet, you know, like Sky News, was, you know, being told not to report on. And
so did you yourself, on. You yourself as a staff journalist, Henry, have ever feel any pressure along the same lines?
Not in terms of the injection debates. I mean, we've had articles, you know, covering that right through the alleged pandemic, as I'll call it. And so, yeah, I think perhaps at a local level that there isn't that level of resistance that perhaps there is at places like Sky News. And, you know, I know lots of people who work at the BBC and they're friends of mine, and they're fantastic journalists, you know, work with them for ages, really want to dig down into stories. But yeah, you do hear that the BBC, if you follow the breadcrumbs, the overall editorial control of the BBC is the government, because it's, you know, it's funded by the taxpayers. So it's not entirely independent, in my opinion.
Well, it's funded, by licence fee payers, which is slightly different, but there is an enormous amount of expectation from the Cabinet Office, for example, that they will phone the Television Centre newsroom up and tell them what the main stories of the day. I mean, actually, one of members of our family did a bit of temping work in the newsroom in London and found that she was putting calls from the...
Sorry to interrupt.
Well, I don't know if I've got... Actually, I think I've got my NUJ mug here too. Look at that. Sad, isn't it?
Brilliant, yeah. So we were both thinking the unions were worthwhile.
It does keep your coffee hotter, though. It definitely keeps your coffee hotter. anyway, so, yeah. So, I mean, what I was referring to was this pressure from Sage was, for example, me being removed from FM by my station manager, Pat Hart, here in Bristol, who's very friendly from a long, long time with our Blairite mayor, Marvin Rees, here, removing me from it. And basically, well, I mean, in an email to me, he was saying that we don't want to have to put up with any or respond to any potential complaints to Ofcom about what you say, so we're taking you off the air. So I mean, I felt very much that the government guidance through Sage and Ofcom led to me being just completely censored off the airwaves from a show I'd been doing for what, 12 years every week, doing holding authority to account here in Bristol, you know, basically doing what journalists should be doing, which is checking up on everybody in power in the city and trying to make sure that the city was run for the benefit of individuals. I mean, we're now in the situation here. I don't know about what the situation is where you are, Henry, is that our city council seems to be being run as if it's a for-profit business, with the local democracy reporters even being excluded from the press briefings because the questions they ask, the mayor doesn't want to answer. And so, we're starting to move from public service, even within our city council here, over to almost a corporate setup. So it's like you're dealing with a for-profit corporation. But anyway, do you want to go on and talk about the other groups that have been set up to counter some of the, what, you know, we might see as, very, very strong lobbying from powerful vested interests?
Well, yeah, just before I do that, just pick up on the local democracy reporter being banned by Bristol Council. You know, I've spoken to colleagues in the Northwest and they're saying, you know, thank God it's not that bad here. So I think in the Northwest, I think we've got more respectable and easier to work with comms departments. And there hasn't been that sort of resistance. And we've had, you know, fantastic access to hospitals, et cetera, throughout the whole alleged pandemic. And an interesting point is, just going back to Anna Breeze again, she was interviewed by David Rose, who's a Daily Mail a freelance reporter, I think, or Daily Mail Online. And he was saying that even though he's like, you know, a decades experience national hack, he's been shouted at down the phone by public relations officers from the, you know, health department saying, right, that's it. We would arrange for you to visit this hospital ward, but you've asked that difficult question. So you're blacklisted now. You're not going to get any help from us again. So these national level health reporters, the Daily Mail anyway, were sort of really struggling to be able to even run health stories because, as a journalist, without contacts, it's incredibly difficult to find out what's going on in these bureaucratic worlds, unless you've got a whistleblower coming forward. But,
well, I mean, yeah. I push it so far as to say this is creeping fascism we're looking at here, because that though if our public servants are simply going to bully and exclude journalists that do their job, then I'm afraid that the Fourth Estate is finished. We've got to push back against that.
And just to bring in the National Union of Journalists again, fantastic work. They've responded immediately to this this reporter being banned by the council at Bristol, saying it's completely unacceptable and it goes against everything in terms of freedoms and holding authority to account. So yeah, good on the National Union of Journalists.
Yeah, and also it's good to see all of the other media outlets in the city, the main newspaper, plus BBC and ITV regional news desks, also boycotting these mayor briefings. If they're going to exclude the local democracy reporters, then none of the major media in Bristol and in the region is going to attend the mayor's briefings, which I think is a great bit of solidarity.
Well, yeah, that hopefully it'll bring about a U-turn. But yeah, as you were saying, I was just going to go on to the various groups that have been sort of set up during the past 2 years. Maybe out of frustration from the lobbying groups that are influencing Sky News, for example, and so there's our group holding the line, Journalists Against COVID Censorship. Then we've also got News Uncut, which is another fantastic group, reporting on issues that perhaps aren't addressed at a sustained level by some of the broadcast TV news outlets. And then you've got the Light newspaper, which really digs down into levels of corruption that you don't find many places elsewhere. And then you've also got alternatives to the National Union of Journalists turning up, like United Free Press, which Kerry Murray set up, and he's fantastic, and he's just driven to create a group that wants to protect journalists, independent particularly in terms of their right to work, not be arrested, to make sure that copyrights are protected from their work and aren't just taken and used elsewhere. And yeah, there are a great collective of journalists who are just really keen to hold authority to account. And you've got various independent citizen journalists cropping up, and there's obviously yourself, there's Anna Breeze, who I've mentioned before. There's countless people. And another name check I'd like to do is at Sheep Farm Studios. They are absolutely fantastic. They do the big deepest dives into the movers and shakers of what's been going on in the world of COVID. And
I thought it was a comedy show.
Oh no, it's not. No, they're proper journalists, in my opinion. They might disagree, but they really do a lot of research, and then they just debate it in a quite sort of light-hearted way, and they do
very well, very light-hearted. Yeah
they have a joke, and they bring on fantastic guests as well, and look into psychology, and I can't recommend them enough as a journalism outlet that I would say they are. Chris and Dom, they're two brothers from Huddersfield or Halifax, I'm not quite sure. I think it's Huddersfield, so they're only down the road from me, so I might pop in and see them one day.
With the Journalists Union, I know people don't necessarily understand the way that unions work, particularly young people. I mean, we were sort of brought up, I mean, I was anyway, in the 70s and 80s, where the unions were very big, the miners' strikes, things like that. And it almost looks to me now as if the rail RMT union is going to be, or the government under Boris Johnson is trying to sort of do to the RMT what Margaret Thatcher did to the mine workers, to try and make an example of them, to break the union. But the fact is that the unions do serve the members, and we have these, well, unique get-togethers. It used to be once a year, an annual delegate meeting. It's now called a DM, which I think is every 2 years. The delegate meetings are where union policy gets decided by the membership. Now, of course, in a political party, wouldn't it be nice if the ordinary members just decided in a party what the policy was on everything? I suppose the Labour Party in its original days was supposed to be like that. It certainly is not anymore. But how did you get on at the delegate meeting? Because it had to be held in the Journalists Union, NUJ, under these COVID conditions on Zoom, didn't it?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, actually. And I got to meet one of the holding the line members there as well. And he's a branch. Well, I'm a branch chairman at the Northwest Lancashire branch of the NUJ, and I think he's somewhere else in the Northwest. And he put forward a motion to have the National Union of Journalists protect its members in terms of their right to work if they didn't want to be injected. With the COVID injections, they might not trust big pharmaceutical companies, for example, or they might have concerns about, allergic reactions or concerns about that yellow card scheme that we mentioned.
Yeah, and they might just simply want to wait until the trials are finished to decide whether the thing is safe or not.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, there's probably another year to go on that. And the trial data already coming out is extremely worrying. I could talk about that at length, perhaps in another interview. But yeah, just a long story short, the union voted, its delegate members voted by 2-1 to protect journalists in terms of their right to work if they didn't want to be injected. And you only wish that, perhaps other unions had followed suit, especially in the health service where, care workers were forced to leave their jobs for not wanting to be injected. And I think there's been a bit of a U-turn on that with the NHS, but, there are moves to, any new staff members brought into the NHS have to have their COVID injection status examined as part of their, agreement to be taken on, unfortunately. So I think, they're sort of looking to bring in this injection mandate via the back door. But again, that's something that journalists can, look at and report on.
Well, another thing that journalists have and many members of the public have noticed, Henry, is the way that the tech giants such as Facebook, Google, YouTube and many, many others have basically made decisions about what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say when it comes to COVID, and particularly deciding that certain things are medical disinformation or misinformation, and basically closing people's accounts, shutting off their ability to say anything on social media if they were to cross certain lines. Now, the thing is that these organisations are not necessarily qualified to make decisions about what is misinformation and what isn't. And they tend to have basically just taken what the World Health Organization has said as gospel.
Yeah, and there's a new one now. I don't know if you've heard of this one. There's malinformation. So this is information that is correct, truthful information, but that's not going to be allowed either. Under this new act, it's called the Online Safety Bill. And if that's approved, malinformation is going to be not allowed. And malinformation is defined by information that's true and accurate, but can upset someone and cause someone harm. So basically, it means information that might challenge the status quo on established narratives, especially global narratives. So, yeah,
well,
a level of censorship that is going to be making life for journalists very, very difficult. And that's something that we're going to be putting pressure off with the NUJ to look at that.
Well, wasn't George Orwell a member of the union?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I know he was.
He was. Most definitely was. George Orwell was. And I think he would be doing a bit more than raising an eyebrow. He might have been scribbling an article about that if he knew about it. Anyway, we're getting to the point where even if you're writing something that's correct and true, you can, under the Online Safety Bill, potentially be even fined for it. Now, we're coming into an Orwellian world, aren't we, where there are various organisations such as Ofcom, etc., that are able to decide what is truth and what is not truth, and actually to punish anybody that says something. But then, of course, as we know, quite a lot of them, for example, with Iraq, there was a fantastic amount of lies went out before the Iraq war about weapons of mass destruction, which didn't actually exist at all. And that was all approved. So, I think we're getting to the point where potentially people will simply not trust what they're seeing on their television screens, reading in their national papers at all, Henry.
Well, yeah, that's why, as a union rep and a branch chairman of the National Union of Journalists, we want that level of trust to increase. So the National Union of Journalists shouldn't just be about, protecting jobs and increasing our pay. It should be about upholding standards. And, the next delegates meeting, I think, is going to be in next year now. So hopefully, both of us will be there, arguing and promoting free speech and arguing against censorship.
Yeah, and maybe having a pint too.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a drift, isn't it? I think, I mean, this is something certainly I've observed over the years, is a drift from hard-nosed investigative journalism amongst newspapers and selling themselves based on, we can do better than another newspaper or television. I mean, think of the things like World in Action, rivalry with Panorama, with First Tuesday on Channel 4. We've got very little of that nowadays, and there is a
Dispatches,
date.
was it Dispatches on Channel
That's
4, was
right,
it?
another one. There was a whole list of these brilliant investigative programs. That was a kind of I've heard Tim Tate talk about it. He was a producer for Granada for a while on World in Action, and talking about it as a very fragile ecosystem, which has slowly, particularly during the 1990s, been broken. So without that, you've got a bit of a potential drift towards media. I mean, our traditional news media becoming almost like a kind of advertising medium.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's like all sorts of levels of journalism, and I've been responsible of writing like stories about shops opening, and you end up writing it a bit like an advertorial rather than a news story because you get taken up with it, and yeah, so I think your journalists just have to be careful that they are looking to be objective and to challenge information like if like for example a health authority boss says we're still in the middle of the pandemic, maybe ask how they define pandemic and then then we can look into those issues that
Yeah,
I
I mean,
mentioned before and
I'm particularly nervous about us drifting towards being a bit like Chinese journalism. I was actually interviewed for a job at the Chinese English Language Channel once, and it was just impossible to take it up because I wouldn't have been able to write anything or say anything really that I actually felt, because there would be constant, you'd be constantly tweaked and told what you're allowed to say. And I'm not being racist. When I went up with some Chinese journalists on an international exchange, I felt they wouldn't say boo to a goose. They were very much the idea of, we just got to write what the government tells us to write, and that was seen as the norm. Now, that may not be the norm amongst Chinese journalists, but they were certainly the norm amongst the people that we met on the exchange, is they didn't seem to have that ability really to anyway. I think this is something which we need as a profession to ensure continues as much as possible, in order to ask those difficult questions, because if they're not asked, the public is going to ask them, and we are in danger, I think, of turning into a sort of propaganda machine. But anyway, the tech giants, let's get back to the Googles, and what can be done about these massively powerful organizations now that basically just anybody that's saying something which is challenging the World Health Organization can just simply be switched off.
yeah, it is an incredibly worrying thing. And I seem to remember, well, the first time we met was at the delegate meeting for the NUJ before the last one. So I think it was 2018, actually, because it was going to be 2020, the next one, and they delayed it because of lockdown. And you put forward a motion, I seem to remember, asking for the NUJ to look at Google, look at how it handled news, how it promoted certain global news, and it downplayed other news, like Bellingcat is promoted as a trusted news source within Google. In my personal opinion, perhaps they're not so trusted if you look at where their funding comes from. And unfortunately, that got voted down by one vote. I think of the
It
300
was a bit of a
there.
knife edge, wasn't it? And I mean, I
Yeah.
basically, I don't, all I'd done is I picked up on some research done by Dr. Robert Epstein in the States. He'd shown that by using algorithms in the run-up to a presidential election in the United States, that Google could skew the search results plus and minus 30% in terms of opinion of the people who were searching on a particular candidate by producing lots of positive results about them or lots of negative results about them, depending on who paid them the most. That is Google, who paid Google the most, or whether the chief executive of Google had decided he was going to back one person or another in an election. And people don't realize how these algorithms operate. They are, well, they're trade secrets. And anyway, I was only just picking up, but it was great to have that debate, wasn't it? I mean, even though I lost, I think the fact, well, it wasn't just me.
Well, 149 people, journalists there, agreed with you. And of course, like, you know, I've used my sort of, it's not a platform as such, but as branch chairman of the Northwest Lancashire branch of the NUJ, I've invited, you know, people like you and Anna Breeze to talk to the members on there. And that, one of the members is Chris Frost, who's he's the chairman of the Ethics Committee of the National Union of Journalists. So he's been made aware of these issues. Like, for example, I mentioned about David Frost, you know, a respected reporter on the national newspaper, not being able to ask difficult questions of health authorities because of, you know, bullying. You know,
David Rose, you're talking about.
Yeah, so did I mispronounce his name or did I say someone else?
David Rose, yeah. I think it was.
But
anyway, just can we get into a bit of your thoughts about working in the mainstream and the sort of pressures that are on journalists working in the mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the points I wanted to mention, actually, when you mentioned the Chinese journalists and, you know, how they are. That you know, that's why I'm sort of, it's controversial to say this, but I'm really proud to work for the mainstream media. It hasn't had an easy time over the past 2 years, staffing levels, you know, and a lot of it was from working from home, so you're distanced from each other. And, you know, there are examples you can give where there haven't been, you know, sustained levels of holding authorities to account, for example. But, you know, the people I work with at the Coalface, they're fantastic. They just want to dig down, get stories, and, you know, just serve the community. And there's, you know, great brand loyalty for the local newspapers in the Northwest, and, you know, all of sort of the online aspects of it. You know, we're getting more and more online people, and you have millions of visits, you know, per month. So, yeah, we're still out there offering, you know, news to, you know, the general public on a local level. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, there's fantastic national newspaper journalists out there as well, and, you know, some of them are, like, you know, News Uncut and Holding the Line, and, you know, as well as working at, you know, the BBC, etc. And it's an incredibly difficult job. You know, people shouldn't criticize it until they've tried it. And, you know, I've been within the industry for decades, and it's, you know, I've got a few more grey hairs as a result, but it's just been fantastic. And I know people who earn, you know, 2-3 times as much money as me going into things like IT and, you know, economics. And, you know, you see them and they've got no joy for the job at all. Whereas, you know, I sort of look forward to going to work and, you know, handling different stories and dealing with different situations. So, yeah, I think in the Western world, you know, as much as things need to be improved to increase trust levels in the mainstream media, we're still, if we weren't there, things would be a whole lot worse. And you could say the same thing about the National Union of Journalists. It doesn't do everything right. It's not perhaps as robust as it could be, but imagine a world where it wasn't there at all, and it wouldn't be very nice.
Yeah, I think it's a bit London-centric, isn't it, the union? But the thing is that the profession is London-centric. So you look forward every day, Henry, to being harangued by the public, do you?
Well, I'm a sub-editor these days, so it's me doing the haranguing of reporters.
Well, I know you went along. I mean, I remember a few months ago you went along to a public meeting and there were people pointing and shouting at you, saying it's a journalist. He's the one who's responsible.
Oh, yeah, I just went with a, you know, that wasn't with any journalistic hat on. So, yeah, it was just a it made me aware, though, that, you know, that's another thing that the National Union of Journalists is working to do, is to protect journalists in terms of, you know, hate messages again from the public, because there are a lot of people, myself included, who started to think that the government narrative was completely skewed and that, you know, we are being railroaded into, you know, via a totalitarian tiptoe, if you like, into a complete loss of our freedoms. And a lot of the public are frustrated with journalists not addressing those issues, perhaps as much as they could do in the mainstream. And then, you know, you get BBC journalists especially, you know, you've had like during protests, people surrounding BBC offices, you know, chanting that, you know, they're corrupt and not reporting the news. So a lot of those BBC staff members are National Union Journalist members, and they need protecting. So how do you protect them? By increasing trust levels in the mainstream news. So yeah, that's something I'm going to work on. And, you know, it's going to be a long, slow process to turn things around. And, you know, I also welcome independent news outlets turning up. And, you know, they do fantastic news, like the Corbett Report. You know, he's one of the best journalists I've ever come across, and he's not had journalism training. And that people like, you know, United Free Press, they're an umbrella organization to protect those newly emerging journalists. So I think there's like a two-strand approach here. The legacy media, if you want to call it that name, can continue trying to hold authority to account. The independent media can also do it, you know, maybe not having the same restrictions as things like Ofcom that the mainstream media you're bound to, you're obliged with. So as long as we've got holding authority account, making sure the government can't pass laws like the Online Safety Bill to completely cripple independent media voices, then I think we can have a healthy, you know, robust news moving into the next few decades. But, you know, it's going to need people like you and me at the coalface continuing to badger the NUJ, you know, top level people and make them aware of things like Google censorship and Facebook censorship, YouTube censorship and Twitter censorship. So, yeah, we're just going to keep fighting.
Well, we are. I think one of the major problems is that from day to day, journalists tend to focus on specific individual stories and they don't step back and see the bigger picture. For example, you know, the deals which were done in 2019 between the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, because the United Nations was strapped for cash. There's suddenly a partnership agreement struck where the Klaus Schwab and his friends at the World Economic Forum come along and say, well, we've got plenty of money. In fact, some of our members are banks and they can just make up money and give it to you. And so the UN has been kind of compromised, really, by being by governments being strapped for cash and them having to go basically along to the private. I mean, I suppose you could see it as a kind of hostile takeover bid by the private sector for the world government. You know, I'm not that the UN ever was a world government, but it's that's the way things seem to be moving. And these kind of big, big strategic changes around the world are not really covered by, you know, just picking away at these individual little bits and pieces of stories. I wonder, Henry, what you make of, you know, the new channels which have popped up here in Britain, such as Talk TV, Talk Radio, which is kind of the same thing, really, which is Murdoch owned, and also GB News, which has popped up too, because they seem to be doing, I mean, particularly I look at someone like Mark Steyn on GB News and think, this is the kind of thing that World in Action used to be doing. This is the kind of thing that BBC Panorama before it was nobbled in the 1980s by Marmaduke Hussey, the chairman of the Board of Governors, sacking Alistair Milne, the Director General, and with the in cahoots with Victor Rothschild, who apparently said to Marmaduke Hussey, can you sack the Director General? I mean, basically, the BBC had been doing some critical films on the Thatcher government, and they decided to use that as an excuse to destroy the editorial power at the BBC to be independent of government. But we've now got the Talk TV, Talk Radio, and the GB News. What do you make of those?
Yeah, I think they're good. I mean, like, do you remember I was talking before about editorial ceilings that, you know, we all operate under? I think the editorial ceilings for the glass ceilings at GB News are still there, but they're a bit higher up, so there's a bit more room for debate, if you know what I mean. But this. Do more. We could all do more. You know, it's like we're saying, it's not an easy job. You've got to keep people on side. You've got audience members who are completely polarized on subjects like Brexit, on lockdowns and injections. So you have to, you know, whatever you report, one side of that polarized debate is going to be upset. So you have to try and get some balance there. So yeah, I welcome these new outlets, and just as long as there's a very broad church and no censorship, I'm not worried about what is debated. Let's just move away from a world where censorship is existing, because you only have a look at history books, and that's where the most devastating times in history are allowed to occur, because of censorship. It's as simple as that.
No, that's right. I mean, I think governments and systems that are losing their credibility, that's one of the first buttons they press. And we've seen that happening, particularly with RT, which I used to be a regular contributor to, even having a column on there, writing a weekly article for RT. That is actually now being blocked by most of the service providers in Britain. I mean, I thought this was something that we were pointing the finger at China and saying, oh, look, China is blocking the internet. Well, actually, no, we are blocking the internet. We're blocking people from seeing what's going on RT. Another one which was blocked by Ofcom something like 8 years ago, 9 years ago now, is the Iranian English language state broadcaster Press TV. I remember from my history books reading about the Nazi propaganda machine back in the 1940s, broadcasting on medium wave from Radio Luxembourg. They had some guy on there called Lord Haw-Haw, William Joyce, who was executed after the war, broadcasting Nazi propaganda right across Europe on this massive, powerful medium wave transmitter in Luxembourg. At no point actually did the British War Office or the Post Office, whatever they were at the time, jam those communications. They could have done, but they made, I think, an intelligent and mature decision that we're not going to jam this, because we're just going to poke fun at what he says. And because that was a fairly easy thing to do, they would satirize him, ridicule him. And they were able to take him on. And of course, although there were probably some Nazi sympathizers in Britain that did listen to this and maybe got some information from it, I don't know, they decided that by censoring what William Joyce was doing, what they would be doing would be showing their own cowardice. And it seems that we have now decided that actually, no, we're going to try and censor what other people say. Because this is a massive debate within the profession, isn't it, over censorship, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and I think, well, that's another aspect of holding the line. You know, we want to raise awareness amongst our peers and colleagues about this censorship and about the online, you know, safety bill, and about, you know, the tech giant censorship and your shadow banning and all sorts of, you know, tactics they've got to silence the other side of the debate. And I think it's a really good point you made there about Lord Haw-Haw. If someone's coming out with an argument that's completely ridiculous, then, so I've got my dog barking in the background, then you can just like have a debate with them and, you know, end of, game over, that side of the debate is lost, because you've given them a platform, allow them to debate with you. You can both put forward evidence. And if your argument has any validity to it, then it will stand. And if it doesn't, it won't. So let's just allow for that debate within all platforms, you know, mainstream, independent, you know, and make it respectful. Let's try and avoid this polarization culture that's arrived, and just allow people to speak, listen to what the other person's saying, try and think of it from their point of view. And then that way you can easily drill down to where the truth is. Mm-hmm. But when you have like, you know, argumentative behavior, and you have people pulling up the drawbridges, not willing to listen to another side of the argument, echo chambers within social media, it makes it really difficult on a human level to have these dialogues. And the best way to do it, I find, is face to face, when you're meeting someone and you can look them in the eye, read their body language, see where they're being, you know, tightening up if they don't like something you're saying, and then you can just listen to what they've got to say. That's a far better way of debate. And, you know, I really hope that is, along with an end to censorship, that debate is promoted, and then we can, you know, avoid terrible situations moving forward.
Well, that's, I mean, this is the power of television, isn't it? That you can actually kind of eyeball whoever it is you're trying to size up. And we can't have a discussion like this, Henry, without mentioning the case of Julian Assange, the, you know, I would consider probably one of the most important investigative journalists of the 21st century who hasn't actually committed a crime in Britain. It looks as if he may actually be sent for life in prison in the United States. And I don't think this sends a very good message around the world. If this does come to pass, let's hope to God that it doesn't, but to somebody like him to be really attacked simply for telling the truth and for exposing embarrassing crimes by the US government particularly, but also by other governments in the on our side, we need to be able to be self-critical. And so what do you make of the Assange case, and which way do you think it's going to go?
Funnily enough, you know, I mentioned the Light newspaper, and I do some sub editing for that, and in the July edition they're covering Assange, so I was, I didn't know much about that topic, but I've read a very in-depth article about it just recently. And hopefully he won't get extradited, you know, but I think it's going to the very last level of appeal now. So it's flip of a coin, who depends who the law lord is, who's going to be covering it. And then, you know, if he is going to go over to the US, there has to be huge amounts of, scrutiny of how he's being treated. And, you know, to move to another journalist, there was a Saudi Arabian one, from memory, who, you know, had his fingers chopped off. So imagine being a journalist in Saudi Arabia now, thinking, oh, I want to hold authority to account. They're just not going to do it if they know they're at personal risk. And that's another fantastic thing the National Union of Journalists does. It raises the issue of journalists being, like, you know, physically threatened and killed across the world. It's not uncommon for journalists to be getting killed around the world. That's another reason we're lucky, of course, where we are in you know, the Western Hemisphere. You know, it doesn't happen, journalists getting killed, but it does elsewhere. So, yeah, with Assange, you know, it just has to have lots of public scrutiny, hopefully within the mainstream and independent media. But we debated about this before. I mean, I've said to you I know nothing about it, but I know people who are respected journalists like Richard D. Hall, who have suspicions that Assange might be controlled opposition. That's another debate I'd like to get into, that term controlled opposition, because I'm not sure I buy it. I think everyone's just got differences of opinion. So,
well, I think Assange has massively embarrassed the, you know, the US behemoth. The other thing, of course, is that the whole process of, incarcerating Assange and this whole business of getting him extradited in a situation where he hasn't actually committed any British crime, surely is a crime in itself. The people involved in that have been perverting the course of justice, and they should themselves be behind bars rather than Julian. But anyway, I think, you know...
Well, just on that topic, I mean, those are sort of quite strong allegations against the courts. So, you know, you have to, if you're going to be reporting on it, yeah, you have to be aware of all the legal aspects. You know, as a former crime reporter, I had lots of law training, and you can't go making allegations like that unless you're confident that you could support those allegations in the court itself. So if you're going to accuse a court of corruption, you have to think, have I got the evidence here to prove in another court that that's the case?
Well, I would be more than happy.
Just go back to the controlled opposition aspect.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that, Henry, personally. I mean, through the personal connections of the judges and these kind of, and just basically looking at the law of the land to do with the way extradition is supposed to work. This is just complete.
Well, yeah, conflicts of interest should be able to be reported. That's 100%. And, you know,
well, for example, a judge should stand aside when a conflict of interest is pointed out, but this one has.
Yeah. I mean, there was a case like that in the Northwest where I think three people were jailed in like a sort of very quick court process for trying to disrupt some of the fracking that was going on near Blackpool. And then it transpired that the magistrate or the judge who sentenced them was a relative or something of someone who had a financial interest in the fracking companies. So, yeah, those jail sentences were quickly quashed and they were given community sentences. So, yeah, there's a great example of, you know, journalists. I think it was Craig Murray actually who raised the issue. Another journalist who's been jailed in this country, by the way, unfortunately. But I don't know much about the details there. But anyway, before I get sidetracked too much, the Assange controlled opposition debate is about how he was set up to then have people funneling information that then the American government could find out who was funneling the information to, Assange would reveal to the government, right, X and Y have been giving me documents. But it doesn't really stack up, that argument, to me, because the amount of harm that WikiLeaks has caused the American government is so massive. Would they really have set up someone to enable whistleblowers to cause them devastating harm?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Vault 7 release, this showed that the United States was prepared to use its ability to hack things like televisions, to listen into people while the televisions were on standby, the possibility of also hacking things like cars and aircraft in order to create crashes, assassinations, this sort of thing. Now, this is massively devastating to the US, and it's the sort of thing that, you know, some of us have suspicious minds like myself that you would have suspected, but to have it actually proven was amazing. Anyway, Henry, are there any sort of closing remarks you'd like to make about the the way things are going with censorship generally and about the health of journalism here in Britain?
I'm like feeling positive, and I think with lots of independent journalist groups are sprouting up. There's sort of crossover groups between the independent media and the legacy media, if you like Holding the Line, News Uncut, and then there's United Free Press. There's loads of great journalism out there. Just have to know where to look, and and journalists within the legacy media, like they're saying, the ones I work with are absolutely fantastic, work really hard, go beyond to make sure they're getting news out, meeting really tough deadlines, and keeping good relationships with our contacts, good relationship with the readers. And listening to all comments on social media, which can help direct where we go on. For example, when we report on injections and things like that now, a lot of comments now are sort of highlighting the conflicts of interest at places like Sage, and how various groups like the Wellcome Trust have got vested interests in big pharmaceutical companies. So I'm confident that moving forward, we've got a very strong foundation of journalism, both in the legacy media and the independent media. And holding authority to account is going to continue.
Yeah, but we've got to keep our guard, I think. Absolutely. All right, Henry. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on for what must be nearly 2 hours, is it? Or 1 hour and a half.
I suppose I should ask, have you got any questions for me, since we're both journalists interviewing each other?
That's a good point, actually, because we were talking about censorship, and it's one of the tragic stories of the past 2 years, is how your respected radio programme got taken off the air because of sort of the Ofcom threats over reporting on anything that conflicted with World Health Organization guidelines. And I don't know how have you managed to keep getting the message out there without having that radio platform?
Well, I mean, it always was a show that went out live on the internet, so it's internet only now. But I mean, it wasn't just Ofcom. I think it was also a close relationship between our mayor Marvin Rees and Patrick Hart, who about 8-9 years ago took over the community radio station. They're old friends, and so. The idea that I would break a story, which I did back about 3 or 4 years ago, about, I suppose we're talking about 2017, 2018, about the mayor's father. I mean, obviously, you can't blame the mayor for what his father did. But the suggestion from Steve Norman, who's a longtime trade unionist in the city, was, well, the mayor was given his tap up on the shoulder to go to Harvard and Yale and get a nice job at the BBC as a result of what his dad did for the establishment. His dad was involved in a big fracas with the leader of the anti-apartheid movement in St. Paul's, where the riots took place back in the 1980s. And, this was basically an attack by an ethnic minority guy on the anti-apartheid movement here in Bristol. It was a pretty shocking story. And I managed to track down Valentine Walker, the mayor's father, as attack who did the attack. I managed to track down the guy he attacked, a guy called Balagoon, over to Gambia, because he'd been driven out of the country back in the 1980s. And he's now training, or he was then anyway, in 2017, involved in training the Gambia's national football team. But he'd been chased out of Bristol all that long time ago by the mayor's father in a court case. The judge said, well, hey, you put a machete into your own neck to try and blame Valentine Walker, Balagoon. And so Valentine Walker walked. And you know, I'd got some of the original articles from 1986, I think it was, from memory, and just said, well, this is an, you know, this is at least what this is what someone is saying. Steve Norman, this long-term trade unionist, very well-respected campaigner, about the mayor and about his dad and about his, you know, the son Marvin Rees getting a fast track to power because of his mayor helping, and was also being accused by a lot of the locals here in St. Paul's of being a police informer at the time. So, you know, this kind of stuff going on behind the scenes is exactly what the sort of investigative journalism I've been doing for years, Henry, as you know, digging into the Bilderbergers, digging into the Freemasons, looking at the latest one I've been doing is about the English Civil War, and the beaching cuts back in 1962, all being at the behest of the oil industry. And the attack on coal with the miners' strikes, all being about energy power. So I was putting out all sorts of stuff, and it was quite disappointing that, you know, my station manager didn't back what I was doing. But it's not surprising since he's so pally with our Blairite mayor.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's anything where a journalist has been silenced, whether it's yourself or this, you know, a local democracy reporter in Bristol being sort of told that you can't go to mayoral briefings, that they're huge red flags to me. That's something that the NUJ, United Free Press, any organisation that's looking after journalism should clamp down on immediately and shine a light where people in authority are blocking journalists from doing their job. You know, that has to be a no-no.
Yeah, and also a no-no is journalists who are just nine-to-fivers. You know, I'm afraid this is one of my bugbears. If people are just simply doing it as if they're, you know, selling soap powder or something, and they're not involved in some way, kind of have a connection with the people doing the reading, the listening, the viewing, whatever it is, I think, you know, we're there for them, and we're their servants. We should be, to a certain extent, not just there to make profits for the shareholders. We should be there to make you know, life easier and to inform on the things that people need to know in order to make the right decisions for the rest of their lives. This is such important work we're doing. It can't just simply be left to commercial interests to buy up anybody that speaks against them and shut them down, Henry.
Well, just to mention one other point there, there is a move in the world, you probably noticed, towards artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence can already write news stories. You know, they can pull data from various, you know, government sources, and, you know, structure a news story there of saying, like, you know, such and such an area has a higher rate of, you know, smokers or, you know, cancer rates compared to the national average. And then maybe a reporter could get a local quote from a public health official. Bob's your uncle, you've got a new story there that 9/10 of it has been written by artificial intelligence. So that's another thing that's a no-no for me and should be for the United Free Press and the National Union of Journalists, is stop any creep towards artificial intelligence outputting the news. There should always be a human element to it.
Well, this is a big part of the rail strike, isn't it, that we've been seeing in June 2022, is the attempt to get rid of all ticket offices, all complete automation, getting rid of guards on trains and this sort of thing. You know, the idea is that us humans are dispensable.
Well, yeah. And yeah, that's something that, just, you know, not wearing any sort of journalistic hat on at all, I'm, you know, worried about. You know, I don't want to be moving into a world where machines and AI can control the world, and you know, touching wood, that's going to be a few thousand years off, so I'm not going to be too worried about it for now.
Well, I mean, I think it's simple as things like going into a supermarket. You know, you can have a nice laugh and a chat and an interaction with a human being checking your stuff out, you know, but you can't really do that with a machine that just says, unexpected item in the bagging area, can you? Anyway, yeah, look, Henry Widdes from Holding the Line. That's
London National Union of Journalists, yeah.
www.holding-the-line.com. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, cheers.